Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Part of my World Cup preparation was to read the ESPN World Cup Companion, everything you need to know about the planet's biggest sports event, because it had everything I needed to know about the planet's biggest sports event. It said so right on the cover. When I had the opportunity to talk with David Hershey and Roger Bennett, the two men who wrote this ambitious book, I began by noting that in the introduction, the authors had characterized the World Cup as the greatest soap opera in sports. I asked Roger Bennett why.
It's very easy to do so. The backstories to the World Cup attract the thinking of both philosophers and tabloid journalists. It's the ultimate high culture, low culture frenzy in which 22 men run around the pitch for 90 minutes in polyester shorts, blithely unaware of the socio-cultural and political weight of the ramification of their exertion. And I think at the end of the day, that's what our book is about. We believe that soccer is about heroes, it's about villains, it's about celebrated strikers, it's about the gentleman who perfected the art of diving and drawing a foul. Mm-hmm. And to understand the World Cup fully, you have to understand the ramifications, the past, the backstories. Otherwise, watching the World Cup without them is a little bit like being invited to watch Lost in the middle of season 3.
David, like a lot of signature sports events, the World Cup wasn't always the big deal that it is today. In fact, England, the country that gave soccer to the world, didn't even send a team to the first several tournaments. Why not?
Well, I think, you know, England has always felt that as the inventors of the game, it's their birthright to win the tournament. And they just didn't feel like it merited their inclusion, I guess, early on. Ever since, of course, each team they field is going to win the World Cup. Amazingly, it's only happened once in the last 40 years.
Besides providing a chronological history of the tournament, the book presents a series of men you've identified as, quote, cult figures of the World Cup. The caption beside a photo of one of these characters reads, "A rare photo of Giuseppe Meazza with his pants on." Explain,
well,
please.
Yeah, well, I wrote that one. You know, everybody has their own idiosyncratic training regimen. Meazza's was essentially to wake up the morning of a game in a brothel next to a couple of women that he had met the night before, and take a taxi to the stadium to meet up with his teammates. The reason they forgave him is that he was such a consummate technician. They let him basically do his own thing off the field. Not unlike, you know, some of the later day heroes like Maradona and others.
Mr. Meazza is said to have shown up at one game still wearing his pajamas. At least one game.
Well, you know, who among us doesn't do that?
I hadn't realized until I read the World Cup Companion how often fixes and bribes had figured in past tournaments. Please start with the deal Benito Mussolini worked with Greece in 1934 to improve the prospects of Italy's team.
The World Cup has, from its very beginning, been used as a political platform by some of the world's most ambitious politicians to cast their own agenda onto the world stage. And Mussolini really pioneered that strategy. In 1934, he made sure that the World Cup came to Italy. He made sure that Italy would win at all costs. And in a critical qualifying game, he'd been building stadia all over the country, incredibly beautiful, pioneering Italian neo-architectural buildings. Italy needed the points to get there, and so he pretty quickly sent his builders across to Greece. They constructed a stunning headquarters for the Greece football authorities. Greece rolled over. Referees were so biased, apparently, in this tournament that one of them headed the ball across the face of goal to a waiting Italian striker to prod home. And to nobody's surprise, Italy were victorious, and mm-hmm. they gave Mussolini the victory that he so craved. What is surprising is that in 1938, they went away from mm-hmm. Italy and were booed by 10,000 anti-fascist protesters who booed their every move. Mussolini dictated to his team that they would have to stand in the Mussolini-esque salute before games while they were being jeered, quote, "until the protesters run out of energy to scream," which they did. They played exquisite football. Against all odds, they won the World Cup again. And the World Cup weathered the war in a shoebox under the bed of the head of the Italian football authorities, who were so terrified that Mussolini was going to melt it down into gold bullion.
The U.S. team met with President Obama and former President Clinton on Thursday as part of their send-off to the World Cup. Besides Mr. Mussolini and Mr. Obama, lots of leaders of various nations have associated themselves with teams headed to the World Cup. Which leaders have most greatly benefited from that association?
The Argentina Junta, I think in 1978, you know, Argentina won the World Cup in their own backyard. There were several controversial moments where the referee would look over at the sidelines and see all the helmeted police and armies, and I think gave the Argentinians the benefit of the doubt.
There was one president who had an amazing affiliation with the American soccer team. In 2002, George Bush II gave the World Cup probably one of its most cryptic presidential moments, when a team very much like this one that had no stars, was egoless, was disciplined, was highly organized, shocked the world by going on an ambitious run through the opening round where they knocked off Portugal, dispatching arch rival Mexico, and then being drawn in the quarterfinal against a fearsome German team. And George Bush phoned the American team up in their locker room. They all gathered round the phone to hear an inspirational message from the leader of the home of the free, and the best he could come out with was, "A lot of people like me who don't know anything about soccer in this country are rooting for you guys." They all looked at each other, shrugged. I think they guessed it was a compliment.
When I started in this business, the sports editor said to me, "Don't waste your time on this sport, kid. It's a game for commie pansies." Well, all I can say is that there are now 4.3 million registered commie pansies playing the sport.
I know you guys have collected a lot of World Cup-related music, which you write about in the book. Here's one of Germany's greatest players, Franz Beckenbauer, singing a 1966 song titled "Good Friends Are Never Separated." Do you suppose that the friends of whom Mr. Beckenbauer sings were Team England?
It's hard to tell, to be honest, but this is an epic song, and I promise you, it's a very dangerous song. It's one of the most contagious pieces of music that you could possibly broadcast on National Public Radio. Your listeners are going to be humming that part Donovan, part Hasselhoff little whispered song all afternoon, I guarantee it. But he was a rock star in post-war Germany, a Germany that was deeply impoverished, was confused about its own identity. Then along he came, using the World Cup as his platform to announce himself to the rest of the world, revolutionising the game by attacking from a deep defensive position. It was only fitting that he recorded a beautiful single that apparently did remarkably well in Germany, because he was kind of the first post-war German rock star.
England figures prominently in your book, no surprise there. They were winners of the World Cup in 1966 and only in 1966, and you write that since then, quote, "it is hard to find a more masochistic, gullible bunch than the English fans." We've got some musical evidence from 1986 to support that claim. So what World Cup song have the English managed to drum up for 2010 that can be possibly as naive as that one?
Well, I think it's quite a shocker, to be honest. The song before that was the first one I ever heard. It was 1982's "This Time We'll Get It Right." And it had all the exuberance and confidence that any good soccer genre song needs. They didn't. They came back with this beauty. It was a team of Gary Lineker, Chris Waddle, Peter Shilton that had a great run actually in 1986, but it introduced me to the incredible optimism that undergirds every English campaign. We write in the book that being a fan of England is akin to being a rubbernecker. The team go through this jingoistic cycle of being sure that their hands will be on the cup, only to find ever more creative and sadomasochistic ways to destroy the hearts of a nation, normally by penalties, often including Argentina or Germany into the mix.
Roberto Baggio's manager at Fiorentina said of his star, "Angels sing in his legs." But I guess even this pales next to the newspaper headline addressed to Salvatore Toto Schillaci after his exceptional performance during the 90 World Cup. Could you read that one for us?
The headline in Italy's tabloids after Schillaci led them to the final was, "Toto, we desire you physically." You know, Toto Schillaci came out of nowhere. He came out of the would be in America the equivalent of single-A baseball to become the surprise star of the 1990 World Cup. And all across Italy, people were naming their children after him. So, you know, today there are lots of 20-year-olds named Toto in Italy who have bulging eyes and a good right foot.
Finally, guys, you've done all the historical research. Did it give you any sense of which team is likely to win it all this year?
The NCAA tournament is easy to gamble on because the teams are coming off a full season where they found their form, their rhythm, their partnerships. World Cup teams are still finding their correct lineup, even as they're in training camp, and it's not until the opening round of this tournament that you can really see who has the true form. Which is one of the things I think that makes it such a delight to watch. I'm looking forward to seeing Brazil. It's going to be a very different Brazil to the mythical Brazil who play the Circus du Soleil kind of flamboyant football. This is a team that's defence first and their pragmatism is going to be very hard to break. I'm excited to see all of the African teams take the pitch as the World Cup comes to that continent for the first time. And it's going to be very interesting to see which of the teams is going to be inspired by 100,000 screaming vuvuzelas on towards victory. But most of all, Bill, I'm looking forward to seeing New Zealand, the ultimate pub team. And when you watch New Zealand, it could be you, it could be me, it could be David taking to the field. They're almost an amateur team in their shambolic nature. And I think that they're just going to be an absolute joy to behold. And if they score a single goal, that will be akin to their victory.
My dark horse is Holland. They've come close in 74 and 78. And I think finally they have achieved the sort of mental stability that has eluded them and will make a run for it.
David Hershey and Roger Bennett are the co-authors of the ESPN World Cup Companion, Everything You Need to Know About the Planet's Biggest Sports Event. It's an ESPN book, and the co-authors join me from NPR in New York. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
And Roger, many thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
My conversation with David Hershey and Roger Bennett, the authors of the ESPN World Cup Companion, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also have a report from Tuesday night's tune-up for the U.S. men's team, their next-to-last game before heading to South Africa. I'll be checking in with our hockey analyst, Helene Elliott, for her take on whether the Flyers or the Blackhawks will be toting home the Stanley Cup, and we'll be counting lead-footed female drivers on both the NASCAR and the IndyCar circuits as the fabled 500 roars into action once again. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.